Hi, I'm Lisa Davis. Welcome to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM. On March 4th, 1990, Hank Gathers, a leading candidate for college basketball's Player of the Year Award, fell to the court at Gersten Pavilion on the campus of Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. Within minutes, a man who led the nation in scoring and rebounding as a junior, who had proudly boasted of being the strongest man alive, was dead. Joining us today is Kyle Kinderling to talk about his moving book, Heart of a Lion, the story of Hank Gathers, the story of a young dreamer and his profound effect on those he left behind. Kyle Kinderling is a freelance writer and author of the critically acclaimed Shooting Star, The Bevo Francis Story. He is a member of the United States Basketball Writers Association and contributed articles to Basketball Times and Lincoln Library of Sports Champions, among others. Kyle, welcome to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM.
Thanks, Lisa. It's nice to be with you.
Yes, I'm so glad to have you on the program. Kyle, I really loved your book, and I needed a lot of tissues to go with it. And in the preface you write, quote, Hank was a role model for all young people who aspire to achieve a goal that seems beyond their grasp. He dared to dream in a place where dreams die. Can you tell us about Hank's upbringing?
Hank was an extraordinary young man. He grew up at a place in North Philadelphia, which one news magazine called the worst slum in America. And I'll tell you, Lisa, I've been there. And it's hard for people like us to imagine that there is a place like that in America, because it was just a place of utter devastation and desolation and depression. And people that lived there were usually poor, and people that lived there usually died poor. Hank, on the other hand, even at the age of 10, looked up at the housing project, 13-story housing project in which he was living at the time, and he said, there's got to be a better place than this. And he went home, and he told his mother that, I'm going to get us out of here. And he was a 10-year-old child when he did that. Now, where everybody else that lived in these projects saw only destruction and devastation and desolation and depression around them, everywhere they looked, Hank saw opportunity, and he saw that opportunity on the basketball court, the asphalt courts in his neighborhood. And the only problem with that was Hank was not a very good athlete. He was tall, but he was not possessed of any natural ability. But he was a strong, strong-willed young man, and he believed that the way that he could get his mom out of the projects and his brothers out of the projects was to excel in basketball, and he literally willed himself to become a basketball player. It took a lot of time, but he was dedicated to doing that. And by the time he graduated from high school, Votech High School in Philadelphia called Dobbins Votech, he was an all-state player and a blue-chip recruit, and he had been recruited by colleges all over the country, along with his teammate Bo Kimball. Bo and Hank were high school teammates, and they were also competitors. But Bo was a natural athlete. Bo was a great natural athlete. Not to say he didn't practice, but he did. But Hank always wanted to outperform Bo, and it made both of them better, really. And they ended up going to the University of Southern California, a little far away from Philadelphia as you can get, and they played there for 1 year together.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I think when people would just see the book and just look at him on the cover, they would assume that he had a natural gift for it. And I was really intrigued, to read that he had to work hard. And you emphasize in the book that he had to work hard at everything.
Yeah. Nothing ever came easy for Hank Gathers. His whole life was a struggle, and but he was determined, and Hank's life was a noble life. I mean, he wasn't out for the glory, and he was out to help his family. And and the only way, which says a lot about our society in 1970-ish, the only way he could see to do that was to make it to the NBA as a professional basketball player.
Yeah, you know, you write in the book about Hank and Bo deciding to go to USC, and a quote, for Hank and Bo, arriving in sunny California was like landing on Mars, and a few transplants from the inner city of Philadelphia felt out of place for a while. I'm sure they did. I mean, what a huge change.
Yeah, they just loved it. I mean, they get out there, and the sun is shining, the palm trees are waving, they're going to the beach. I mean, if you could see what they came from, you would understand. I mean, it was just the polar opposite of where they grew up, and they loved Southern California, which is an important thing because they only lasted 1 year at USC, and when the coach was fired there, the coach that had recruited them was Stan Morrison, and when he was fired after their freshman season there, they had really been given an ultimatum by the new coach, and who didn't really handle them very well, and they had to find a place to play, and they wanted desperately to stay in Southern California, and a series of weird coincidences and ironies take place where the priest that had really mentored them back in Philadelphia, Father David Hagen was his name, and Father Hagen had had a connection out on the West Coast with Paul Westhead, who had come from Philadelphia. So there's all this Philadelphia connection going on, and they're out there in California. And Hagen said to Bo and Hank, why don't you talk to Paul Westhead? He's at Loyola Marymount University. Now, this university, while the campus is absolutely gorgeous, beautiful place, tranquil, I mean, it's just a lovely, lovely campus. But they weren't known for basketball. They were known. They were lucky if they got one paragraph in the Los Angeles Times when Hank and Bo arrived there. But within the period of 4 or 5 years, they were nationally known.
Well, now why did Paul Westhead, the coach at LMU, Loyola Marymount University, why did he call Hank the Bank?
Hank the Bank. Well, Paul was funny. Paul had a nickname for everybody. Now, usually it was just the first initial of their last name.
Okay.
But with Hank, he always called Hank the Bank. And I asked him the same question. And he said, because when Hank Gathers had the ball in the paint, it was as good as money in the bank. That was before all the bank failures. That was before the recent history of banks. But that's what he called him, and that was Hank's nickname was the Bank or the Bank Man, and and the teammates referred to him that way too.
Now, also, you talk about the Hank and Bo show, which you had just alluded to before,
right,
that there wasn't a lot going on in basketball at LMU before they came along.
Right. Yeah. Hank and Bo were gifted athletes, and the team that Paul West had put together was an exciting, fan-friendly basketball team, which is part of the story, really, because what he emphasized was something called the system, which is a fast-paced, run-until-you-drop kind of basketball. And Paul West had played the system everywhere he went, from high school to college, to the pros, everywhere he went, he ran the same system. But the system demanded, absolutely demanded, athletes be in top physical condition because the premise behind the system was that they would run the other teams into the ground, and if they didn't win, the team would certainly know that they'd been in a fight. So they were scoring 122 points a game, and they were on television all the time. This little school, 4,000 students, little school with 4,000 students was on CBS and ESPN all the time because people just loved to watch. The goal of the system was to put up a shot every 4 or 5 seconds. That's what they did. And they scored 122 points a game, averaged 122 points a game, which is still the highest average ever by a college team.
That's incredible. Yeah, you mentioned that Hank's record-smashing season of 1988-89 made him a figure of national interest. And then Hank also had gotten involved at KTLA, if you can tell us a little about that.
Yeah, Hank was he was a communications major, as Bo was too, and at LMU. And Hank did his own cable television show out there, and he would do halftime reports. And he interned at KTLA in Los Angeles with Ed Arnold, the sports director there. And he was very good. He was funny. He was spontaneous, and he worked just as hard to learn the business of television as he did to learn how to play basketball. And he would have, Ed Arnold told me he would have had a great career after basketball, had he lived after basketball, as a television commentator or analyst.
You know, that's something that, and I'm kind of jumping ahead, but Dr. Swerdlow, who was one of the doctors who was treating him, actually said, quote, better a live sportscaster than a dead basketball player. And that's when they discovered that he had had an issue with his heart. And if you can tell us about that.
Well, during Hank's last season at LMU, he had led the nation in scoring and rebounding as a junior, but he came back to school to get his degree and to get his team into the NCAA further than they had ever gone. So in his senior season, in December of that season, against the University of California, Santa Barbara, he was at the free throw line, December 9th of 1989. And he passed out. He fell to the court. And almost immediately he arose. But they took him out of the game and took him to the locker room and examined him. The doctors that were there, of course, were from the world-famous Curlin Job Clinic, which is an orthopedic clinic, the ones that perfected the Tommy John surgery for baseball pitchers. And these orthopedic doctors got him into the locker room and said, you know, there's something wrong here. Your heart's racing like crazy, and we got to put you in the hospital. And Hank, of course, violently objected to this because he needed to get to the NBA, and if he had a heart problem, the NBA wouldn't have anything to do with him. So apart from that, he was forced to go to the hospital. The hospital conducted a series of tests and brought in Dr. Charles Swerdlow, who was an electrophysiologist, and they conducted tests on Hank. They could not determine the cause of his arrhythmia, but he had a serious arrhythmia problem. And after a number, I think he was in the hospital for 3 days, and given every test you could possibly give, they decided to put him on a drug called Inderol, which was the standard treatment drug at the time for arrhythmia problems. But what you mentioned was that Swerdlow, who's the EP, the electrophysiologist, had serious concerns about Hank continuing to play competitive basketball, especially in a system that demanded the type of exertion that the system that Paul Lestad was playing demanded. But the other doctor, Dr. Vernon Hattori, who was the doctor, the cardiologist that was handling Hank's case, thought that basketball meant so much to Hank that he would try to prescribe Inderol and keep him playing while on the drug to control his arrhythmia. He started him on 200 milligrams of Inderol a day, which worked, but it also turned Hank into a zombie, and Hank as a zombie wasn't going to make the NBA. So what began in December and ended in March was a continuing battle between Hank Gathers, 6'7", 235 pounds, chiseled like a Greek god, and this little owl, this little cardiologist who was treating him, and Hank just continued to batter and batter and batter this doctor into reducing his dosage so he could play at the level he needed to play. And of course, at the end, by March 4th, 1990, Hank had convinced this doctor to reduce his medication from 200 milligrams a day of Inderol down to 40 milligrams of Inderol. And what I found out, Lisa, in the book was that Hank wasn't even taking that medication. He had decided that he could stop taking it. He decided to stop taking it on the day of a game, which is exactly in contradiction to the instructions the doctor had given him. And on March 4th, 1990, 20 years ago, plus a few months, Hank fell to the court again, and this time he didn't get up. And the man who claimed himself to be the strongest man alive, the man with the heart of a lion, had been betrayed by the very organ that defined him, and he died literally on the court.
I was so sad, and his family was there. It was just heartbreaking.
In front of 4,000 people, his mother, his brothers, his aunt. It was a horrific scene. And one of the things that's kind of interesting, I don't know whether it would happen today or not, but in those days, in 1990, ESPN showed the rather graphic film that was shot at the game of Hank actually dying on the court, and people sitting in their living rooms back here in Boston and New Jersey and New York and the East Coast saw it on Sports Center. And Hank had a 6-year-old son who was living in Philadelphia with his mother, and that's how his son found out his father had died. It was really a very tragic thing.
The whole story is so sad, and then afterwards, just all the legal problems and the blaming and the whole—it was just terrible.
I know. Hank, who had been on the cover of basketball magazines and sports magazines, was now the subject of articles in the New England Journal of Medicine and the legal forums and medical forums about sudden death in athletes, and it all centered around Hank because he was such a high-profile player. Other young athletes die, and they do every year, but one that is at the pinnacle of the game, such as Hank Gaddis, has attracted a huge amount of publicity, and it lasted over 2 years, and before the case went, the family hired an attorney out in Los Angeles who sued everybody, and eventually they settled out of court and received something like $2 million. But you have to remember, at that time, if Hank had lived, if Hank had gone on into the NBA draft, he would have signed for something like $10 million. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, but the legacy is kind of important because of all the publicity surrounding Hank's death, there was a heightened awareness of the risks of sudden death in young athletes, and that awareness led to some more stringent protocols and examinations and so forth, and hopefully it saved lives, and hopefully it still continues to. Bo Kimble, his friend, has established a foundation called 44 for Life, and that 44 was Hank Gather's uniform number. And 44 for Life attempts to educate people about CPR and the use of defibrillators and just to prevent another Hank Gathers from happening. And it's a great tribute to Hank, and it's part of Hank's legacy that he continues to save lives to this day.
Oh, that's wonderful. Kyle, I really encourage everyone to read this book, Heart of a Lion. Just remember to have some tissues with you. It's inspiring, it's sad, it's moving, it's a wonderful book. Now, how can people learn more about you and your terrific work?
Hank, the website for the book is just hankgathersbook.com, and we have a number of articles and information up there, and you can find the website link there, too, for Bo Kimble's Foundation. And I think, you know, the story is sad, but I think it's also inspirational because Hank made great strides from where he came from, and as I said, he continues to this day to save lives. So
yeah,
he's gone, but not forgot.
Oh, definitely. Well, if people want to reach me, they can go to itsyourhealthradio.org. I hope everyone has a great day. Keep being healthy. Take care. Bye.